Welcome back to the Football Fitness Federation podcast. This is episode 282, and this episode is with Marcus Hannon. Marcus is the performance nutritionist at Aspire Academy and also for the Qatar national team as well, fresh off the back of a win at the Asia Cup, which was great to see. So we had a number of different topics that we covered in this episode, including some of the cultural differences that he has had with different players from different parts of the world, how that impacts his approach to nutrition with those players. We spoke about Ramadan and nutrition during Ramadan and some of the lessons Marcus has learned over his time in Qatar. He also spoke about the differences with nutrition roles in a club versus a national team and also academy to first team as well. And then right at the end, we expanded on the recent episode with Phil Learney, which was around night games. And we spoke about fueling for night games, so some considerations for before games to fuel, but also some important considerations for after games and the day after a game as well. Now, it's a very exciting time for our networking events because we've got three events coming up soon. Next week, as this podcast goes out, we're going to be over at Everton at Goodison Park. That's Wednesday, the 20th of March. We've got lead physical performance coach at Everton Women, Chloe Edwards, owner of Malone Performance, James Malone, and also Aston Villa senior academy sports scientist James Coneboy, all presenting at that event. And tickets are still available for that event. Then the week after, which is Wednesday the 27th of March, we're going to be at West Brom at the Hawthorns. So that's 27th of March, 6 till 9 p.m. We've got a great lineup of speakers. Youth athlete consultant physio Angela Jackson is going to be presenting alongside expert in football science and practice Barry Drust. So tickets are still available for that one as well on the website. And a special podcast exclusive is that we are going to be heading back over to Dublin on Thursday the 11th of April. And we've got, again, a great lineup of speakers. Paul McGrath, who's head of performance at St. Pat's Athletic and lecturer at TU Dublin, is going to be presenting alongside Shane Malone, who's head of sports science at the Dublin GAA and lecturer at TU Dublin as well. So it'll be great to see as many coaches representing over in Dublin again, like our last event. Tickets are available for all the events. If you go to footballfitfed.com, click the shop and the networking events, they are all available there. And just a quick heads up that if you come in with a friend or colleague, we've now got special offers on a two-ticket offer. So you can purchase two tickets in one for a slightly cheaper rate. And make sure that if you're a community member, you do also get further discounts on the tickets as well. So make sure you check out the codes in the WhatsApp group, in the information on the WhatsApp group, or it is available on the website in Network Meeting News section of the community too. So make sure you go and check those out and insert those codes to get your member discount. Let's get into our sponsors. So make sure you go and follow our sponsors. They're doing some amazing work. First up, The Good Prep. The Good Prep is a meal prep delivery service that provides fresh, ready-to-eat, chef-cooked meals straight to your door. They offer meal plans tailored to your personal goals, current activity level, and schedule. The Good Prep works closely with elite-level athletes and corporates to develop meal solutions that meet the ever-changing demands of performance and training. Their clients include Brighton Hove Albion, the PGMOL, Commonwealth teams, Gymshark, and many more. Their meals are full of all the nutrients you need to keep you in peak performance so you can achieve every goal you set. Plus, you can reclaim your time, eat better, move more, and reduce food waste too. Their meal plans are designed to guide you through a journey to a healthier you. Take the guesswork out of healthy eating and discover the power of nutrition at thegoodprep.com. And make sure you use the code FFF15 for 15% off your first order. This podcast is brought to you by Hytro, the number one BFR brand in pro sport, helping teams and athletes improve performance and recover faster with their blood flow restriction wearables. Built for sport, proven by science. Check out Hytro.com to find out more. Also, go and check out our longest serving sponsors, that is Rezl. doing some brilliant work in the world of VR. Check out at Rezl over on social media to see what it's all about. Let's get into episode 282 with performance nutritionist Marcus Hannan.
Rezl is the world's number one virtual reality sports trainer. Whatever your team, your sport, your ability, improve your game and train like a pro. Rezl. Reactions, performance, accuracy, stamina, resilience. Train at home in the Rezl Sports and Fitness VR Training Arena. Search Rezl, R-E-Z-Z-I-L. Harder, stronger, smarter. The world's number one virtual reality sports trainer. Available now on MetaQuest.
Welcome back to the Football Fitness Federation podcast. This is episode 282. I'm delighted to welcome onto the podcast today, Marcus Hannan. Marcus, how are you doing?
Ben, thanks for having me on, mate. It's been a while, but we got there in the end.
We did, no, and I really appreciate you giving up your time to come on because I know it's been a bit of a crazy period, which we're going to dive into in a little bit, but lots of success along the way as well. So it'd be great to get into what you've been doing recently and what's been going on. But we always start the podcast in the same place, and that's on you and your background. So can you just give us a little bit of a rundown on your career so far?
Yep, no worries. So as you can probably tell from the accent, originally from Belfast, Northern Ireland. And yeah, I haven't lived there in a long time now. But I guess from a professional perspective, like most people working in sport nowadays, I went to university to get the knowledge. So I went to Oxford Brookes, did an undergraduate degree in nutrition and sports science there. And during there was probably my first exposure to professional sport. I used to go down once a week to Oxford United, who were in League Two at the time, volunteered there, general sort of sports science roles, nutrition roles, whatever I could do to help out and gain experience. Did that. Following that, I then went to Liverpool John Murray's University and did a master's in sport nutrition. So that was a, but at the time I did it, it was a new course. It was, I think, the second year it was running. So met some amazing people there, great place, great facilities, great institute. And I was very lucky during my time there to gain some great mentors, you know, who are still mentors today. So after those, you know, couple of years of my undergraduate, my master's, gaining, you know, voluntary experience and internships and placements, my first paid job was then with Ulster Rugby, Ulster Academy. So I did a maternity cover there. So I did a nutrition, sport nutrition, maternity cover. Short and sweet, but that was my first paid gig in sport. After that, I then went to Everton. So Everton was 2016, that was. Interesting project. So it was the first full-time nutrition program that the club had. So I came in as a team of three. Myself, so I oversaw the academy side of things. I had Lloyd Parker, who oversaw the first team side of things. And then Graham Close, who was a consultant. So the three of us went in and, you know, it was a blank canvas. It was an amazing opportunity. And, you know, I had a great time there. And actually I'm very fortunate to have Lloyd joining me out here in a couple of weeks' time. So Lloyd's joining me out in Qatar in a few weeks. So come full circle a little bit there. During my time at Everton, I also completed a PhD. So that was an embedded PhD. So whilst I did my day-to-day practice within the academy there and within the club, I also conducted my research, specifically looking at the energy requirements of academy footballers. So as they come into the academy pathway and as they progress up to senior level football, how do the nutritional and specifically the energy requirements change? So yeah, that was, you know, just over 3 years at Everton. I spent a year in rugby with Northampton Saints, rugby union team. And then I went to Aston Villa. So I was head of nutrition at Aston Villa for nearly 3 years. That was similar to Everton in the fact that it was the first full-time nutrition program that the club had had. So I was predominantly working for a club-wide nutrition program. So we brought in academy nutritionist Ruben Stables. And we made some big changes there within the club. And we really embedded nutrition into the performance department and put part of the performance service there. And then in 2022, so September 2022, I moved to Qatar, moved to sunny Doha, where I'm currently lead performance nutritionist for Aspire Academy and also the Qatar Football Association. And as I mentioned, Lloyd's coming out. That role is overseeing the Aspire side of things and Qatar Football Association, but that role is going to be split now when Lloyd comes out. So Lloyd will oversee the academy, which is the national academy feeder into the national teams, and I'll oversee the Qatar FA nutrition pathway and first team. So yeah, that's sort of a whistle stop tour of me and my journey to where I am today.
Awesome, mate. And fresh off the back of an Asian Cup victory as well.
Yes. So we won the Asian Cup back there about a month ago now. So we won it back to back. So the Asian Cup, I think we were fifth going into the competition, ranked fifth. Japan were heavy favourites. Had come off a good run over the last sort of 12, 18 months, but yeah, managed to beat Jordan in the final. And win it back to back. So yeah, quite amazing when you think of the pool of players in Qatar. The pool of professional players is about 250 professional players within Qatar. About a third of them are overseas players. So when you look at it in the grand scheme of things, it's quite an achievement.
Definitely. Yeah, no, it's massive. You've referenced there a few times about the different programs, and you said about the blank canvas going into certain clubs. Can you give a little bit of a breakdown what nutrition looks like overall at the minute in terms of the roles available? Because you speak to some practitioners at clubs, and they might have a consultant nutritionist that comes into the club on a few days a week. You speak to others that have got full time, they might have a team of nutritionists. It seems to be quite sort of spread out and sporadic in terms of the opportunity. So what's your view on that, and what would you say the current state of play is?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, Ben. And I suppose nutrition's a young discipline. Of all the sort of sports science and performance disciplines, it's one of the newer disciplines. When I started, say 10 years ago, full-time nutrition, let's speak about football here. Full-time nutrition roles within football, cool. I'm not sure there were too many at all.
Yeah.
10 years ago, as I said, when we started at Everton 2016, that was we were the first sort of full-time program there at Villa, that first full-time program. I think if you look at it now, if we look at the first team level, first team end of things, you look at clubs like Tottenham, who now have three full-time practitioners working with the first team, so I think within the Premier League that's the most, and I think that's amazing. Personally, when you think about nutrition's something that happens all the time, 24 hours, 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year. It's not like training where, you train 4 or 5 days a week. Your nutrition's always happening. We want players to eat 4 to 6 times a day. They're drinking all the, many more than that. So it's always happening. So if you really want to get down into the detail, you need people and you need coaches, nutrition practitioners and coaches to educate these athletes to really get down to that high level of detail. I think I'm not sure within the Premier League now. I think most clubs have a full-time practitioner, so I'm almost certain. If you then look at the academy side of things, and the academy is, as you would expect, lags behind first team, just because of the resource and funding available. We published a survey there a couple of years ago, led by Dan Carney, and that looked at, it was an audit really of nutrition provision within clubs across the different categories. So as you would expect, category one academies have a lot more service provision and nutrition support compared to category two, three, four. But then if you look even within irrespective of categories, I think if you look at the provision, a lot of it's top heavy. So PDP phase, under 18s, under 21s is where most of the support will lie. Again, because it's getting towards that professional end and some of the senior stakeholders, academy managers, head of performance, head of sports science and medicine, that's where they probably see fit. Whereas, you know, some of the research we've done over the last 6, 7, 8 years, we would argue that you need that nutrition support all the way down the academy. You know, if you think about the nutritional, you know, the growth and maturation that's occurring, the physical development, the high energy requirements, the busy schedules that they have, you know, schooling schedules, traveling schedules, training schedules. You know, if you look at the training of academy footballers from a volume perspective, they're often doing more than first team players. You know, it's not uncommon to see academy players do 35, even 40K weeks, you know, from a load perspective. So that's probably, I don't know if that's given you an answer, but I think it's certainly moved on in 10 years. And I think in another 10 years, it will be, you know, it'll move on again. I think people are really starting to see the value in it, you know, not only at first team level, but at academy level too.
100%. No, I really like the fact that you brought that up, because I think the other things you're sort of battling against that academy in those younger age groups is just general society and understanding of nutrition as well, isn't it? And a lot of that will filter from parents too. But then the other side of like academy is the buildup of like habits, isn't it, throughout those younger age groups. If they're going to build up something through the younger age groups into an under 18s, and they've built some positive habits along the way, surely working with that under 18 at that time is going to be a little bit easier than just getting someone that's fresh, that's not really done any of it before.
Without a doubt. You've touched on a couple of points there, Ben. The first one was the parents, the influence of parents. And again, if you think about it, at 11, 12, 13, 14-year-old kid, it's the parents that are doing the shopping, the parents that are doing the cooking, deciding what's having, that the kid's having. So, you know, they're really as important to influence and educate as much as the player at those younger ages. And I think, and again, even more reason to have more full-time practitioners at those younger age groups, because not only are you working with the players, you're working with their parents.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to have real impact, that's what you need to target and focus upon. And then I guess, as you said, secondly, if you get that right, you know, the person at the top, if somebody's been through, you know, from 12 years of age through a nutrition program, you know, 12s, 13s, 14s, if it's done in the right way, if they've been educated in the right manner, if they've, you know, developed the right habits, the first team nutritionist at the club it's minimal, minimal intervention there.
Yeah. And I suppose the other thing at that first team level is then they've got more resource, isn't it? That you see players having chefs, and because they've got that more sort of financial backing behind them, whereas at those younger age groups, they haven't.
Absolutely. Of course, there's more resource at the top end, yes. But again, if you think of it from a practitioner perspective, a practitioner within the academy might be looking after 100 plus players, 100, 120 players. So the level of detail you can get down to is difficult to get to real levels of detail. If someone's working with just a first team on a full-time basis, say 25, 30 players in a squad, you know, you can get down into some real high-level detail. You know, for real specific things, match day minus one, pre-match meals, in-game, you know, recovery, hydration strategies, so, you know, rehab, injury. You can get down into nice detail there, but to do that for 120 players is difficult.
Yeah.
It's challenging.
Yeah, 100%. I thought it'd be really good to get your insight into some of the cultural differences from some of the players that you've worked with. So you mentioned some of the teams that you've been at over in the UK, but also with your current role now. So how has culture influenced your practice, like your understanding, the flexibility that you maybe needed to develop within your practice? Can you give a little rundown of that?
Yeah, it's, you know, football or professional football now is, I think when I was at Villa, that I think there was at one stage 14 nationalities in the squad.
Yeah.
You know, so you've got players from, you know, all corners of the world, South American players, African players, you know, from all over. Moving here, there's, you know, Qatar is an interesting place. It's, you know, it's in the Middle East. It's a population of 3 million people, but there's only 300,000 Qataris. So most of the population here are expats.
Yeah.
You know, you've a lot of people from the Middle East, a lot of people from Asia, North Africa, European. So it's a melting pot of culture, and you know, makes it a really diverse place. So I think you, from a practice point of view, you understand, you know, I think the more cultures and things you're exposed to, you understand, you know, I think we're going to come on to it. Ramadan, you know, for example, you know, Qatar is a predominantly Muslim country, like most of the Middle East. So, you know, at the minute, we're now on the third day of Ramadan. So again, that has significant implications for, say, nutrition during this period of time. Of course, you know, anywhere you go in the world, there's certain cultural habits, practices, foods, traditions, you know, here that, you know, the Qataris love karak, which is a very, very, very sweet tea. I think it's personally disgusting, but they'll drink a lot of karak. Dates, you know, there's certain salads, hummus, baba ganoush, fattoush, tabbouleh, certain. So I think understanding the different foods and sort of traditions and cultural habits is important. And I guess in, I suppose, like the UK, a lot of social gatherings are done around food and drink, but in Qatar and the Middle East, there's a big focus on social gatherings, family gatherings, wide family gatherings, so extended family, and a lot of that revolves around food.
Yeah.
So Friday morning is Friday's the real religious day, a prayer day, so they're Friday morning prayers, and after that, the large extended families will typically get together and have massive feasts. You know, interesting to see, but you know, a nightmare from a nutrition perspective. in Qatar and in the Middle East in general, the locals will sit in a room called a majlis room, so it's like a common room, social room, where they'll sit and socialize, and you know, that often involves sitting drinking karak, you know, a lot of sweet tea, a lot of sugars, a lot of biscuits, chocolates, those kind of things. So, you know, but again, it happens, and you need to be aware of that within practice, and yeah, to be aware of it and have an understanding. And if you're working with a player, you know, understand that these are the behaviors and cultural traditions, I suppose. I think in Qatar specifically, Qatar's big problems, you know, public health issues. So obesity is massive here, diabetes is massive here. It's a wealthy nation, so everything's accessible, it's convenient, you know, there's a high intake of fast foods, there's a high intake of desserts, you know, sweet foods, and so the nutrition within the general population is pretty poor. Now combine that with the families generally live together, extended families live together, so I work with players who still live at home, mom or grandmother will still do the cooking, so their knowledge of nutrition there is poor. What they cook from a nutritional perspective isn't ideal from an athlete's perspective. It's not athlete focused or appropriate. So, you know, that all comes into play there. And I think in Qatar and the Middle East, sleep is a big issue. So they stay up very late. They wake early for prayer, the first prayer of the day, Fajr prayer. So, you know, that consistent sleep is often broken. You know, it's not uncommon for people to sleep 4 and 5 hours a night here. Wow. You know, regularly they drink a lot of caffeine, so sweet tea, karak, but they drink a lot of coffee as well. And they'll drink that late into the evening. So sleep durations poor, sleep quality can probably be poor as well. You know, and you know, the lack of sleep then has detrimental impact on nutritional, you know, dietary intake, behaviors, etc. So look, from a cultural perspective, it's you know, there's a lot, you know, I'm speaking about this context here in Doha and in Qatar, is very different, but you know, I suppose that's no different if you were working in other parts of the world. There's many different cultural factors that you have to consider before then getting into, you know, the general nutrition, before getting into the sports nutrition.
Yeah, no, I think the understanding side, sorry to cut you off, but the understanding side, I love that you bring that up, because that is something straight away that when you're talking about the day-to-day there, it's just so different to in the UK, isn't it? That yeah. If you went in and just right, this is my blueprint, this is how we work, it's just not going to be worth anything, is it? Well, you understand, and then I'm guessing then you start to put things in place.
Yeah, absolutely. It's for me, it's so important. I mean, I've been here 18 months now. As I said, it's Ramadan at the minute, but last Ramadan, I didn't intervene really too much.
Yeah.
I just wanted to learn, understand, observe. This year I have a better understanding and a better understanding of what the players do, I have a better relationship with the players, so we can start to work on things, and we are starting to work on things. But I think just to add, to come back to the sport nutrition practice, I suppose, sport nutrition, as I said, as a discipline, is young. But in the UK, it's pretty advanced compared to the rest. You know, Australia, UK, it's pretty advanced. But sport nutrition in Qatar, and specifically in Qatar football, it's in its infancy. So again, you've got these cultural challenges, issues. You know, you can't come in two-footed here and, you know, start really pushing them on certain things. So as they say in Arabic, shway, shway, slowly, slowly. You know, we're just tackling some of the basics at the minute. And then we are, you know, shway, shway, getting towards where we want to be. But yeah, it's important to understand, I think, first.
No, that's brilliant. Can you give a little insight into maybe some of the things that you've put in place initially? Because even you talking through it then, there's probably coaches thinking, right, I've got a list of 10, 15, 20 things that they're the interventions that I'd make. But it'd be interesting just to hear your thoughts on, obviously, you've mentioned sleep, you've mentioned some of the nutrition, but that also ties in with culture and just generally what they're doing with the family and things like that. So it'd be really interesting to hear about maybe some of the first couple of interventions that you're thinking.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. So it probably ties into all of what we've just spoken about. But breakfast, a lot of players here just don't eat breakfast.
Yeah,
or you know, skip breakfast. Again, it's because they go to bed late. You know, if we look at the younger players when in Aspire, they go to bed late. They have to be up for school. You know, so you know, one of the things that they do in Aspire, which is being useful to improve breakfast intake and dietary intake at breakfast, is rather than put breakfast on before school. So the players within Aspire Academy will have breakfast, lunch and dinner within the academy, the full-time players. Rather than have breakfast has been moved after the first period, because the players have to be there for school. You know, if you put on breakfast first, they were skipping breakfast and going first straight to the first period. So move breakfast after first period, you know, automatically breakfast is there, it's on for you. There's time in the schedule. So, you know, breakfast intake, boom, through the roof.
Yeah.
So little tweaks like that. But then, you know, with the national team players that I'm working with, again, what you'll get is players going to bed at 2, 3 in the morning. Your breakfast is on from, I don't know, until 10, and then missing that. So again, it's just real basic education around and coaching around, this is the importance of breakfast. Why it's important, you know, and, you know, specific days, you know, okay, this, let's start with match day minus one or match day. You can't miss breakfast this day. If you're going to miss it, these are the better days, you know, so a slowly, slowly approach. Basic things in game from a performance nutrition perspective, things like fueling, you know, basic carbohydrate fueling. Now they're getting up towards 60 grams of carbohydrate an hour. At the start, they weren't. So again, we've gone into more detail around, you know, fueling, match day minus one, match day fueling, hydration. Hydration is something that was horrendous here when I came out, you know, just basic hydration testing. 95% of the players failing that. You know, we're now in a lot better place there. But so, you know, it's basic stuff, but important from a nutrition perspective.
We've uploaded all four of the presentations from our recent event at Colchester to our online community, so you can head on and check those out, including a presentation by highly experienced head of performance in elite sport, Dave Carolan. Dave spoke about how to develop your career, finding your USP, networking, performing a personal audit, and plenty other key bits of information around the career puzzle and developing your career. So you can go and check that on the community right now in the network meeting presentation section on the community. I'm also excited to announce that we are going to be starting to do a live stream of some of our networking events, starting with the event at West Brom. So if you're a member of the community and you're in our WhatsApp group, you will get access to a live stream of our events, of some of our events. So if you can't make it to the event, obviously you'll get the recording afterwards that you can watch back, but you can actually tune in to the event live. And when we get to the questions and the Q&A part, you can take part in that Q&A as well. So that is coming for our West Brom event. We'll also be doing it for our Dublin event as well. So another big perk of being a community member. And if all that wasn't enough to get you to join the community, then we've also linked up with Strength Condition Education, and we're partnering with them. So they're the industry leaders in S&C education. So we've linked up with them to provide our members with an exclusive discount to some of their courses, and yeah, the courses that they offer. So you can go and check those out on the member benefits section of the community right now. Something we've been wanting to do for a while is have somewhere we can direct our members to upskill. They've got a range of different courses that you can go and do. So go and check that out in that section on the community. And it's great to link up with the guys at Strength Conditioning Education. If you're looking to join, make sure you go to footballfitfed.com, click the community tab and sign yourself up there to a free 30-day trial to see what it's all about. Let's get into part two of the podcast now with Marcus Hannon.
But for you in that position as a practitioner, I know Lloyd coming out as well, that must be exciting in terms of you've got such impact that you can make. And like you said, it's going to be done over time. Well, you must look at that and think, like, this is something that in a few years' time, it could be a completely different program having such a big impact.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's that was one of the attractions of coming here. Qatar football is unique, I suppose. You've got Aspire Academy, which is the feeder academy to the national teams. And then you've got the Qatar Stars League. But nutrition's in its infancy here. So, you know, when I come out, there was two of us. When Lloyd comes out, there'll be five of us. And, you know, we're hoping to get more practitioners within the clubs, within the Stars League. So, you know, if we set it up right, you know, over the next 5-6 years, the kids that are coming through Aspire, hopefully have a good understanding of good dietary habits, behaviours to when they get to the national team. And, you know, resource is not an issue out here. So from a staffing point of view, it is amazing. We've got good ratio of staff to players. And we've got all possibilities. You know, we're redoing the canteen at the minute within Aspire. So that's a big project. We're looking at integrating certain technologies into that. So, you know, it's a fantastic opportunity to really develop something good.
Yeah, brilliant. You mentioned it before about Ramadan. Can you just, before you go into how that impacts your role and the work with players and the changes that are made within scheduling, just give us a little rundown in terms of Ramadan and what that actually involves, just for people that don't understand?
Yeah. Okay, So Ramadan it's a month. So Islam as a religion has five core pillars. So one of which is fasting for the month of Ramadan. So all Muslims have to fast for the full month. Now, there are certain exceptions. If you're ill, if you have certain disease like diabetes, if you're pregnant, breastfeeding. From an athlete, if you travel outside of your home country, you don't have to fast, but you have to make up the days later. So anyway, if Ramadan is a month, it's a 30-day period of fasting from Fajr prayer, which is about 1 hour before sunrise, until sunset. So no eating, drinking, no chewing gum, no smoking, so nothing in the mouth, no sexual activity. So it's a real religious month for all Muslims, and they take it very seriously. Is a month that they consider good deeds are multiplied, you know, when it comes to their final day, when Allah judges them. So, you know, it's a special, very special occasion for them. It's a time of celebration. It's a real time of celebration and deep-rooted cultural practices, traditional cultural practices. So from a nutrition perspective, that can be challenging, and we'll come on to that. So as I said, it's a 30-day period. It's the month of Ramadan, which is the ninth month of the lunar calendar. So the ninth month of the Islamic calendar. So that's different to the Gregorian calendar. So the lunar calendar goes on the moons. The Gregorian calendar is, you know, January to December. So it moves forward every year by around 10 or 11 days.
Yeah.
So when I was first working at Villa, it was the first time I worked with any Muslim athletes who were observing Ramadan fasting, but also training and playing. So that was May. That was May, the first Ramadan I did. And the fasting hours was about, you know, 4 in the morning to about 9 at night. So it was about 17 hours fasting.
Yeah.
The players during that period had to train and play as well. Whereas in the Middle East, the schedules are adjusted. So the working days are less. It's things like the lifestyle changes. So things like restaurants won't open until iftar, until sunset. So, you know, that life generally slows down here. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting period. And then from an athlete's perspective, for me, it's a lot easier than for athletes here and players here than compared to, say, the UK, for example, you know, back in the summer that they would have to, because what will happen is here is players will, they will have their iftar, so they will break their fast at sunset. They will have iftar. They will generally have a couple of hours and then they will train and play. So training at the minute, so to tonight, iftar is 35 minutes. It's a 17:45 tonight. And then players will typically train around 9 o'clock at night. So yeah. They'll train. Fixtures are moved. So international fixtures obviously is an international calendar. They don't change, but within the sort of Middle East and predominantly Muslim countries, if they can adjust the schedules, they will. Competition schedules, this is. So, for example, we have two upcoming World Cup qualifiers against Kuwait next week and the following week. So we will play Kuwait and our kickoffs at 10 o'clock at night. So Kuwait, yeah. another predominantly Muslim country. So we will have iftar, which is the breaking of the fast. We will play the game and then after. Now during Ramadan, it's an interesting period. So deep-rooted cultural and religious practices. But what you will have is iftar is a time of celebration. So, and Ramadan is a time of celebration. So if you, an iftar is breaking of the fast, typically families and friends will get together for a feast, heavy fat foods, heavily fried foods, high sugar foods, real energy dense foods. It's not something you can come in and start changing really straight away. It's you know, it's difficult. But I think having an awareness of that. So if you think of like Christmas in the Christian calendar or Easter, it's like that every day for 30 days.
Yeah.
So it's challenging. It can be challenging, and you know, body composition can be an issue with certain players because they are being exposed to and they're eating these high fried, high fat foods or high sugar foods every single day. Sleeping, obviously, a lot of players here will go nocturnal, so they will stay up throughout the night. They will go to bed after. So sahur is the last meal they can have before dawn. So yeah. Before Fajr prayer. And then you have sunrise. So after sahur and the Fajr prayer, which is about 4:30 in the morning here at the minute, players will then go to sleep and, wow. You know, often sleep to 2 or 3 in the afternoon.
Yeah.
Wow. So a lot of challenges, but as I said, I think Ramadan is very context specific, where you are in the world. You know, because if you have long fasting hours and it's during difficult weather conditions like summer, you know, if you have very, you know, 17, 18 hours of fasting in hot conditions, that's a lot more difficult. And your schedule's not changed from a training and competition point of view, that's a lot more difficult than, say, a winter Ramadan in the Middle East where the schedules change, the competition schedules changed. You know, it's very, very different.
Yeah, no, it's incredible. I'm really interested and intrigued about, obviously, there's the changes over in Qatar in terms of how the scheduling changes and everything about that. But when you've been in the clubs over here and you've dealt with those long fasts, it just amazes me that players can, because you see it all the time, don't you, during Ramadan, players breaking the fast during night games, maybe, but still performing, and they've still trained all week. And it's not so much the food, it's the hydration, isn't it? You spoke about the importance of hydration before, but it's incredible, really, that they can maintain such high standards. So what how do they do it?
Look, it is fascinating. It was actually, I was speaking to someone the other day, and I think Liverpool in the 2019 Champions League final, you had Mane and Salah both fasting. That was that final was during Ramadan. So
yeah,
and I think part of that match was during the fasting. So I think they broke their fat. They had their iftar during that final. Look, I think I'm actually fasting at the minute. It's last year I didn't do it. I've decided to do it this year just to understand better. The fasting for me, from a food perspective, I've had no hunger. I've been absolutely fine from a food perspective. But the first day, my mouth was like Gandhi's flip-flop. I was so thirsty.
Yeah.
Yesterday wasn't as bad, and today's not as bad again. But it's the thirst. I think when you look at, you know, from a performance, let's look at football match play performance. We know that carbohydrates the main fuel, so they have opportunity to eat. Probably, you know, they have about an 8-hour window to eat, so they can get do have opportunity to, let's say, carbohydrate load the day before a game. They have that opportunity. And now, once that muscle is full with glycogen, you know, muscle glycogen, that's full until that glycogen is used during high intensity exercise, it's not going anywhere. So from a muscle glycogen perspective, it's full. I guess from a liver glycogen, that will deplete as time goes on, and, you know, as they sleep and as they fast, that will deplete. So that, you know, from a nutrition perspective, that's something you want to try to top up when they're breaking their fast. You know, if the breaking of the fast is before kickoff, or if the breaking of the fast is during, you know, a match, you're just looking for, you know, real fast release sugars, so sports drinks, gels, you know, those kind of things. And then the hydration is another one. You lose water naturally at rest, but then to do that and then to train, to not drink it, yeah, so players do become, you know, quite dehydrated during fasting hours, I would say. The other interesting thing is the first night, you know, you hear of players talk about not taking electrolytes. You know, I've had a couple of conversations in the last couple of weeks about not taking electrolytes, because they, you know, specifically at certain times, players will take electrolytes at iftar time. So when they break the fast, to try to get hydrated again, but much after that, they won't. And the other night I actually tried it before the first day of fasting, and electrolytes and sodium drive a thirst sensation. So
yeah,
they cause you to become so thirsty. So, you know, it's the balance. You know, you want to get hydrated as soon as you can, but then, you know, you want to keep that hydration intake going throughout the non-fasting hours. But then, you know, at Sahur time, you don't have big boluses, you don't have big volumes of liquid, and you also don't want to have high amounts of sodium or electrolytes. That'll, you know, the large volumes of water that you have will produce urine, so cause you to become dehydrated, you know, more quickly. The sodium and the electrolytes will drive that thirst. So yeah, it's interesting. But, you know, to enable that performance, sorry to come back to you, I've gone off on a rant there. To come back to your question, you know, yes, you can perform. The muscle glycogen is there, you know, which is, you know, driving performance. But, you know, hydration is an issue which will negatively affect performance. And, you know, exogenous carbohydrates, so external carbohydrate that you're consuming, if you're competing during fast hours, will be an issue as well.
And in terms of that performance during this time, what are some of the differences you see?
So, as I said, currently in Qatar, the schedule is very kind to players here. So all of our training is now about 8:30 or 9:00 at night. As I said, we have two upcoming fixtures against Kuwait, home and away. The kickoffs are 10 o'clock, so players can break their fast at 5:45, 6 o'clock, have, you know, your typical pre-match meal, to have an opportunity to rehydrate, have an opportunity to fuel, and then perform. You know, from a performance perspective, the players here have been doing it so long as well. You know, they've been fasting for since 10, 11, 12 years of age, you know, and there's certain players here that are, you know, 30, 32, 33. So they've been doing it for the most of their life. So I think from a performance perspective, you probably don't see much of a performance decrement. I think if, you know, it's football, so it's multifaceted, isn't it, in terms of the performance. So I think if you're looking at a sport that is like pure endurance or pure power output, cycling or running or something, maybe it'll be affected a little bit more. But I think football performance in the Middle East during Ramadan, I would argue is you know, not really affected.
Yeah, I know, it's incredible. And you're dead right with that. And you're like, I'm thinking of it, and I know you've been in a similar situation, that we're thinking of it from our perspective of us doing that right now. But if we'd done it for however many years beforehand, it's a different thing, isn't it? And players are used to it. And that's something that we've done another couple of episodes around this topic before. And that's what practitioners have spoke about, that players just get on with it. They know what they're doing. Obviously, there's things that they can change and do things better. But overall, that it's what their life is throughout this time. And they've got a real reason behind it as well, haven't they, which drives it even more.
Yeah, it's Islamic people, and Muslims are very, very, you know, they pray five times a day, and, you know, the religion they hold very closely to them. And this is one of the core five pillars, as I said, of Islam. So, you know, it is a very personal and religious time for them. So, yeah, you have to respect that.
Yeah, 100%.
And as we've said there, you know, these lads have been doing it a lot longer than me. And I, you know, I'm a non-Muslim person who didn't grow up in a predominantly Muslim society. So, you know, they're guiding me. You know, I have some sport nutrition knowledge, so they're guiding me, and I'm trying to help where I can. But, you know, I'm trying not to, do this or this way or the highway kind of thing.
Yeah, no, 100%. That makes sense. I wanted to touch on as well your experiences within the national team or the country, working with a national team and having these fixtures that come around whenever it is. They're spread out a little bit more. Your contact with players will probably be a little bit less compared to the day-to-day club, and how that looks and whether your approach changes or is it just manipulated a little bit in terms of the time?
No, it's an interesting question. You know, club football is, you're with players 6-7 days a week for 11 months of the year. So there's a lot of contact time. International football's peaks and troughs. You know, you've September, October, November, March, June, international FIFA windows, plus your major competitions. So for example, for the Asian Cup there, we had a couple of weeks preparation and then we had the competition. So we were together for 8 weeks. So big block of time.
Yeah.
But I guess Qatar football is unique in the fact that all the national team players play in the league here, the Qatar Stars League. So every player. Now the league, Qatar's a tiny country. Qatar's really only Doha as a city. So the league is based in a city. So the furthest you have to travel for a game is 1 hour. You know, all the players live in Doha. So the players at these clubs, most of these clubs don't have nutritionists. There's a couple of clubs that do have nutritionists within the league. So, you know, if I want to see a player, I can call them into the national team headquarters at Aspire. So I get access to players here a lot more compared to, say, in England, where you have to travel up to Newcastle or down to Southampton to see a player. So actually the contact time's a lot more compared to the most international. So I can structure that like a club in terms of what I want to do with the players, and if I want to see them regularly, I can. But obviously you have those dense, condensed periods where you're with them, you know, 24 hours a day for weeks on end.
Yeah, no, definitely. I suppose the thing is with that is if the football in Qatar keeps progressing the way it is, you've got potential that players are going to start going around the world, aren't they, into the different leagues, and then obviously that becomes more of a challenge then, doesn't
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the biggest challenge. You know, there is players within the current national team setup that have played, and Akram played in Spain, I think Villarreal. There's players that have played in the European leagues.
Yeah.
One of the things is they get paid to pay for the national team as well as the club contract. So it makes it attractive for them now. But yeah, I think that is a challenge. When you know, if you're an international practitioner, nutritionist working with club players, I think it's the biggest thing is for me, keeping the continuity, you know, doing what you can when you're with them, but also keeping continuity. And I think that comes down to the relationships with the club's practitioners and your relationships with the players, and understanding what they've been working on, and trying to continue that when they come into camps and competitions, and you just being able to facilitate that, and then adding value where you think you can.
Yeah, brilliant. Marcus, I want to sort of wrap us up and tie this end of the podcast in with a previous podcast, which we did with Phil Learney. It was all around night games. We talked about caffeine. We spoke about sleep. We spoke about light exposure. And I wanted to just get your perspective on looking at these night games, which obviously a lot of coaches, that's going to be within their schedule. Preparing players, what are some of the key considerations we need to make on a nutrition standpoint for fueling players the right way, both pre-game but also post or the next day?
Yeah, interesting question, Ben. I mean, looking, if you take the Premier League, for example, you could have fixtures at 12:30, 3 o'clock, 5:30, 8 o'clock. So you've got quite a spread. And I know, you know, a lot of players don't like those 8 o'clock kickoffs because you're hanging, especially if it's an away game, you're hanging around a hotel all day.
Yeah.
From a nutrition perspective, look, for me, the biggest performance priority is getting them carbohydrate loaded. And that occurs the day before, match day minus one. So if you have done that properly and a player has adhered to what you've asked them to do and they've carbohydrate loaded, the muscle will be full, you know, when they go to sleep, match day minus one. So actually, from a nutrition perspective, all you're trying to do is top up liver glycogen on match day, and make sure that they're hydrated going into the game. And then, you know, you can use supplements, you know, prior to kickoff, things like caffeine, you know, might be beneficial as well. If we let's take an 8 o'clock or even a 10 o'clock example, as you know, we have in, you know, next week, you know, the focus on the fueling the day before, we will do that. To top up liver glycogen, we use things like fruits and fruit juices and smoothies. You know, a lot of players don't want to feel heavy. So often, you know, on an 8 o'clock game, you could have, there's potential that they could have a breakfast, a lunch, a pre-match meal. They can feel heavy, and they might actually need all that food, you know, to perform optimally. So I think it's working with players. I think it's important to understand how, you know, their thoughts and get feedback from them on, you know, feelings of fullness and lethargy. You know, I know a lot of players in those late games like to sleep and have naps.
Yeah.
It may or may not be beneficial, you know, may or may not be beneficial to get them out, you know, into some light earlier in the day as well. So, you know, they're all things that that I work on. So individualized plan, making sure they're not doing too much and eating too much. They're having the right things, but and making sure they're hydrated. We always do hydration tests on a match day. That's something that we always do. And I hear it's funny, actually, in the UK, there's a big focus on a big, heavy pre-match meal, you know, irrespective of time, whereas that's not a big focus here. And it made me think a little bit more around match day and what players do and what do they actually need. But I think if you've done your job the day before, it makes the pre-match meal not as important, but there's less focus on it.
Yeah.
You don't have to put in as much. I think then if you, you know, let's take caffeine, as I mentioned then. So you might have players taking relatively high doses of caffeine before, say, an 8 o'clock kickoff. That we know that players sleep impaired anyway after a game, that with the adrenaline and everything that's going on, that can be amplified with then caffeine. So, you know, it's not uncommon for players after an 8 o'clock kickoff to be still awake at 3-4 in the morning. It's not uncommon at all. So I think, you know, in that acute period after those couple of hours after, you know, it depends when your next fixture is, but depending on how aggressive you need to be from a nutrition perspective. You know, obviously a lot of players will have the 30 to 60 minutes that recovery shake, carb, protein, recovery shake, will then want them to eat a meal after that as well. You know, a high carbohydrate, high protein meal, within the hour or two after the match finishes. Depending on, you may use certain supplements as well to help sleep, to help with the recovery process too. So I guess a lot of that depends on the proximity to your next fixture. You know, if you're playing again in 48, 72 hours, you know, it's a kitchen sink job. If you're playing week to week, you don't have to be as aggressive with those, you know, nutrition and hydration strategies.
I know it's certainly like a big picture view, isn't it? Which is why you spoke about sort of match day minus one and other aspects go into it rather than just focusing solely on the pre-match meal, like you've talked about. Either it's not the only thing that's important. But looking at that bigger picture and extending that after the game then into the next day, when they probably have had a disturbed sleep, they might be going in to do a light session. They might then have a game after that. So in turn, what are some considerations for that day?
Yeah, so if there's a fixture in what, say 2-3 days?
Yeah.
So I from a nutrition perspective, it's just about the high carbohydrate diet, again, replenishing muscle, liver glycogen. The muscle's damaged, so muscle glycogen replenishment is more difficult. You know, you have to consume higher amounts of carbohydrate there. So real high amounts of carbohydrate. You're trying to get them hydrated as well. So I'll use things like very high carbohydrate drinks, carbohydrate powders, make them into drinks, you know, so 60 grams of carbohydrate per drink, you know, use a couple of them throughout the day. So you're trying to, you know, you're up towards 8 grams per kilo of carbohydrate throughout that plus one, plus two even. Plus two can also be minus one. From a, you know, muscle damage point of view, you obviously want the protein to be high protein intake and regular throughout the day. And again, there's certain supplements I'll use like turmeric to try to reduce inflammation and the domsy feeling as well.
Yeah. No, that's brilliant, mate. Brilliant. No, it gives a quite a full-rounded sort of view of, because we spoke a little bit more about like a blueprint beforehand, and adding that on top of it in terms of the key considerations, I think is great. And I've loved talking about all the difference in culture and also just your approach. Like, understanding is a big part, and that goes into obviously what you do, but it also goes into a number of different roles as well, people stepping into new positions. So no, I really appreciate you doing it, Mark. It's been great to catch up, and I don't want to keep you all day because I know you've got some special plans later today as well. So no, I really appreciate you coming on.
No, thanks for having me on, Ben. I've enjoyed the chat, and speak soon, mate. Appreciate
Thank you, mate.
I hope you enjoyed that episode. And also, just before we get into the takeaways, big thank you to everyone that's reached out. I've had a lot of really nice messages recently about the quality of guests that we're getting on the podcast, and that people are taking a lot from these episodes, which is amazing to hear. And obviously, in terms of support, little messages like that do the world of good, because we never know how many it's going to go out to when we're actually recording the podcast. But please, I know there's a lot of people out there that do share the episodes, but it does help us massively in terms of improving reach. So if you've listened to an episode and you've enjoyed it, please give it a share, whether that's into like a private WhatsApp group, or whether that's on your social media, your Instagram, your Twitter, your Facebook, or literally just sending it out to people. However you can share it, I really do appreciate it, because it massively helps us increase the listeners, and that helps us get really good quality guests on as well, like Marcus and the guests that we've had on recently. So big thank you to everyone that's done that recently. And a big thank you to Marcus for coming on. Like you mentioned, I've been chasing him for a while, like a lot of these guests recently, because I knew the quality that he would bring. And it was great to get his experiences around nutrition, and especially everything in terms of his current role around culture. There's a lot of crossovers from what we spoke about what Mark has covered in terms of initial approaches going into a new culture, a new environment, a lot of crossovers from nutrition to the strength work, to fitness work, in terms of not changing everything straight away, educating yourself, learning about the culture. I think that's all really, really important. Obviously, something that Marcus has taken, he's taken his time to do. He mentioned that Ramadan last year, he didn't make any changes. And then this year, after learning about it, after fasting himself as well, which is something Amy O'Keefe spoke about in the episode we did with her not that long ago. She spoke about the same thing, actually going through those experiences and understanding it. I think that's really key. So yeah, he's taking his time to make those changes. But from the things that he pointed out, it's such an exciting role because there's so much that there's so much impact he can have in that role. So it'd be great to watch that journey over the next few years. It was also interesting around the opportunities within nutrition that he said sort of 10 years ago, there's probably no full-time positions and they're growing now. A lot of the Premier League clubs have got full-time coaches, but full-time nutritionists. But also there's a lot of clubs that still haven't. So you like to see that develop over the next few years. The importance of parents, which is a massive part of nutrition through academy players. So if you're in an academy and you're looking to make those changes and apply some nutrition strategies with players, you've got to bear in mind that it is the players doing the shopping, the parents doing the shopping, the parents doing the cooking as well. So they're the ones that we've got to have an influence on. And we know that within society as a whole, speaking very, very broadly, the knowledge around nutrition probably isn't the best. So that is what we're trying to cover. So we've got to bear that in mind when we are thinking about fueling and we are talking to academy players about nutrition as well. And then also, he spoke around the match day minus one. Nutrition at that point, the sort of pre-match meal isn't the be-all and end-all. The day before is important, but it's also big picture. We obviously spoke about the day after the game, and there's a lot that comes into it in terms of when your next game is. And I think it tied in really nicely with the episode with Phil Learney. If you've not listened to that episode, make sure you go back and listen to it, because Phil spoke about use of caffeine, sleep, light exposure all around the evening game. And Marcus has just put another layer on top of that in terms of nutrition requirements now as well. So you've got a really good insight across the two episodes around how to prepare for night games and also recovery afterwards as well. So I hope you enjoyed the episode. I'm sure you took plenty away from this one. Go and give Marcus a follow over on Twitter, and he's also, you can link up with him on LinkedIn as well. And make sure to go and check out our sponsors, Rezl, Good Prep, and Hytro, all doing some incredible work, and I really appreciate their support. And I will speak to you again next week in episode 283.